Good evening. We'd like everyone to try to get seated so we can begin. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of River Styx Magazine and Big River Association to Duff's this evening. Special welcome to those of you who are here for the first time, and also a special welcome to old friends who are here time and time again. And we hope some of you who are here for the first time will become old friends very fast. We've started a new tradition this year by way of trying to start as on time as we can and also to kind of create an atmosphere to present our featured artists. We like to do, to invite writers and artists to convoke, invoke, provoke our meeting here tonight. And we're really happy to have in that office a face that's familiar to virtually all who have been to Duff's on occasion. He's kind of like the house philosopher who's always here at the readings and always kibitzing with the artists between and after, but is a voice in his own right who we'd like to kind of take the role of the opener of this reading. So again, to bring us together by way of convocation, to make sure the spirits are with us by way of invocation, and perhaps to get something churning in you by way of provocation, here is Jim Igo.
I always figure these meetings are kind of like commemorations, so that's the note that I'd like to strike. And I'll give you two kinds of memory. The one is from the past and one is from the future. The one from the past is there was a big gang of beings that was with us all summer. And they were musical beings, I realized. They're gone now, or they've changed their abode. I'm speaking of the cicadas. And I was over in the park trying to figure out what their song was. And a person came out to me that was like kind of like, wee-o, wee-o, wee-o. And then I went and looked it up in an encyclopedia and found out that they did it from the stomach instead of from the throat. So it goes like, wee-o, wee-o, wee-o. That's early in the evening. Early in the morning, they go like, easy, easy, easy. That's from the past. Now, this other one is addressed to poets. I got it out of Mother Jones magazine. That's by a poet named Carolyn Fourche, who I'm sure some of you have heard. And in Mother Jones magazine, the last issue, there was a section that had to do with four more years. I think this will kind of be self-explanatory. And the note is that Carolyn Fourche, whose book, The Country Between Us, was the 1981 Lamont selection of the Academy of American Poets. Fourche lives in New York City, and this is what she wrote. It was born in America sacred, sent to the heavens on cedar smoke, a history chanted in a symphony of tongues until it passed like blood into the ground, rising in hard wind through leaves of grass, lifting the curtains of Emily Dickinson's impassioned solitude. When entrusted to white caretakers, it traveled for years to Europe, yet remained in the fields of the South, became work music, followed the banjo into American song, flowered in the diaries of prairie women. It found its accompaniment in the bells pounded by Chinese railroad crews, in the clanging acts of a northeast farmer striking fieldstone. It remained free, could not be sold, and so was thought worthless, without price, like the air, like fresh water, open land, a given. We tell ourselves that we don't understand poetry. Perhaps we do not wish to understand. The poets of today's America have found refuge, the privileged and tenured academy. The younger teachers, in their annual treks to temporary jobs. The unlucky in their few free hours stolen from the exhaustion of labor in factories, offices, and shops. There are also the poets who sleep in their junk cars under highway bridges, tapping out poems on crusted royal portables. They are educated and voluntarily poor, more fortunate by virtue of choice than the millions of Americans who have fallen into poverty during the past 4 years from the height, one supposes, of frozen bedclothes and cat food suppers to the level of the men and women who live on the streets, eating pizza crusts from split garbage sacks and wrapping themselves in those sacks when it rains. Soon they will begin their annual search for smoking sewer grates. Perhaps they will survive 4 more years under a president blind to them, if any of us do. We can say that now because it is true and recognized by most of us to be so. We are the poets of the nuclear age, perhaps the last poets, and some of us fear what the muse is telling us. Some of us are finding it harder to write. A few of us have turned from our dazed introspection, the contemplation of iced trees, vacant barns, winter loss, our sepia-washed memories, the delicate and empty language we have borrowed from each other to escape the necessities of our time, and we've begun to give voice to the collective foreboding, tired and uneasy, but still requiring ordinary hope. There is no metaphor for the end of the world, and it is horrible to search for one. Suppose, then, that we will survive under the protection of a man who envisions extending his destructive powers beyond our fragile atmosphere, one who believes that the very existence of nuclear weapons is the best deterrent to their use. Suppose the poetic spirit chooses to remain with us. What of the other dangers of this president? During his tenure, we have begun to write poetry in a country where Anne Frank, the Diary of a Young Girl, has been pulled from the shelves, and where such treasures of the American spirit as The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, A Farewell to Arms, The Scarlet Letter, The Catcher in the Rye, The Grapes of Wrath, and To Kill a Mockingbird appear on a list of the 30 most censored books. We write in a country that refuses to permit Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Graham Greene to travel freely, as Pablo Neruda and Julio Cortazar were refused in the recent past, and where Norma and Mel Gabler of Longview, Texas, have appointed themselves moral guardians of our children, compiling lists of offending school books for the convenience of community censors. We have a president who initially proposed that the budget for military bands be larger than for all other arts combined. Under his guidance, First Amendment rights have eroded, and the press has been censored and has censored itself with mysterious humility. What is poetry, wrote Czesław Miłosz, which does not save nations or people? A connivance with official lies, a song of drunkards whose throats will be cut in a moment. Just as we've come to recognize the long poisoning of our air and water, perhaps we should begin to protest the imprisonment of the word, made captive by our voluntary silence, no less than by those who fear its freedom. The American poetic spirit cried out in Ginsberg's Howl, chanted its way through marches against racism, sexism, and the Vietnam War, slept exhausted in volumes of acceptable poetry, floated out over the coughs and applause of its student audience, rode the radio waves as rap music, and went heavenward again in the smoke of book burnings, where, from the vantage point of its beginnings, it returns to us with warnings. This is the task, as one poet wrote to another, to make for our America a destiny that would not fill us with shame. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Carolyn Forshay.